Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll get a preview of Mission Creek Festival 2023 coming up this weekend in Iowa City. I'll talk with two members of the trio, BCJ's Peas. But first, Grant Faulkner is an award-winning writer who spends a whole lot of his time inspiring other writers. He's the executive director of NaNoWriMo, that's National Novel Writing Month, and co-founder of the 100-Word Story. In addition to his work in fiction, he has published his third book on the craft of writing. This time, he makes the case for writing within very tight boundaries. The book is called The Art of Brevity, Crafting the Very Short Story. And Grant Faulkner is on the line with me now. Hello.
Hey, Charity. Thanks for having me today.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I think we should start with your Iowa credentials, because you have a lot of them. You grew up in Oskaloosa, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Oskaloosa. My mom still lives there. Love it.
Nice. You also went to Grinnell College, and then you worked for the Des Moines Register.
I did put in a year at the Des Moines Register. I was voted most likely to move furthest away in my high school class, but went to Grinnell in spite of that, and actually did go kind of far away at Grinnell in my mind.
Nice. All right. When did you start writing?
You know, I remember wanting to be a writer or identifying as a writer from as my earliest memory, even before I knew how to write books. I remember running downstairs to tell my mother a whole idea for a series of books that I had. And I'm sure that was before I could actually write letters or words. So it's always been a part of who I am.
What did you envision your career as a writer would be like as you started going to college and taking those classes and really crafting your future?
That's a great story, because I think a lot of young writers, their romantic vision of what it is will be like to be a writer is quite different than the reality of it. But that's a wonderful experience as well. But when I was 20, and at Grinnell, I was deciding between two majors, or deciding my major, and I was deciding between economics and English. And I very fortunately went to study abroad in France that semester, and basically sat around cafes reading novels and writing, and very, very luckily identified as an English major, not an econ major. But, you know, I read all of the novels of, you know, by writers who lived in Paris in the 1920s. So they were all very romantic. And I did envision my life as being somewhat like that, you know, traveling the world, living in different places, writing novels in cafes. And, you know, I did a little bit of that. But, you know, the reality of being a writer is that not many people can do that and make a living. So you have to find other ways to make a living and other ways to fit writing and creativity into your life. And you know, working within those constraints has also been very meaningful to me. I don't think necessarily that having an ideal writing life is even maybe good for you.
This book focuses on flash fiction. It's called The Art of Brevity. So first, for people who have never heard of flash fiction before, why don't we define it? What does that mean to you?
That's a good question. You know, it's typically defined as stories under 1,000 words. But I think it really is, I don't like to define it by word count. I like to define it by feeling or aesthetic. And I have a whole chapter in the book about different metaphors for flash fiction. So like one metaphor is just flash fiction is the moment you hit the brakes on a car. It's the moment when the world stops suddenly and dramatically. And the critic Irving Howe, he defined flash fiction as epiphanies ripped from their context. So they're really about an intense moment, usually. And in fact, James Thomas, the person who came up with the phrase flash fiction, he was talking with his wife. He was calling them, he was responsible for a lot of the anthologies that came out in the 80s and 90s that popularized flash fiction, but he didn't have a word for them. And he and his wife were talking about it, and they were living in Ohio, and this was actually the winter. And suddenly a lightning bolt came out of the sky, and it was this one big burst of illumination. And so that's the metaphor that he chose for it. So I think, I think it's an aesthetic, and it's a feeling, and it's a different type of story.
When did you first encounter it?
You know, I encountered it early on as a writer, but I didn't embrace it until I was a little bit older. I'd been working on a novel for 10 years or so, off and on, and I was very frustrated with it. It was what I call now my doomed novel. And a friend of mine posted a link to his father's, some excerpts from his father's memoir online. It's called Sport and Jackins, written by Paul Strome. And his memoir was made up of 100 word stories. And I thought it was so cool the way that every one of these little 100-word stories, it was like a snapshot from a Kodak carousel. And they weren't necessarily unified into a conventional narrative with a traditional narrative arc. They were each kind of their own separate thing, but in conversation with each other. And I thought it was so neat the way that they allowed him to capture the smaller moments in his life that might not be thought of as memoir material, but those smaller moments weren't small in significance. And so I started just playing around with the form, kind of as a break from my novel. It really gave me some creative momentum or creative juice just to write something and complete it. But I could only get them down to about 150 words. And I told Paul that, and he said, no, you've got to go shorter. The shorter you go, getting them to precisely 100 words will make them better. And I did that. I kept practicing. And writing 100-word stories is largely about practice. And once I did get them down to 100 words, they were better. And the reason for that is not that 100 is a magic number of any sort. It's more the amount of attention that goes into the writing to get them to 100. It's like writing a sonnet or a villanelle. You're following certain rules and certain constraints that bring out a different type of creativity. So for these 100-word stories, it was kind of like a Rubik's Cube for me. That's the way the metaphor I think of, is that I was kind of twisting it around back and forth to get all the colors to line up. And because of that intense focus on each word and each sentence, and because I couldn't have any flab in the story, I think they really did. It's essentially my form of writing poetry. That's the way I think about it. I'm not really a poet, but these little stories are kind of like prose poems.
Well, I was going to ask you, what is the difference between a 100-word story and writing a prose poem? But maybe we'll talk more about that in a few minutes, because I think it's so hard until you read one to wrap your mind around how long 100 words is and how much can be conveyed in that short a space. Would you read a 100-word story for us?
Sure. Yeah, and I think... just so people can visualize the link, it's really a kind of typical paragraph, I think. And I oftentimes get asked, because I run 100wordstory.org, the magazine, about whether a 100-word story can be a conventional short story, meaning that it has a beginning, middle, and end, and meaning that it has a character change. And my answer is always yes. I think 90 to 95% of the stories we get fit that criteria. But they can be something else as well. So this story is called Shirley Temple. I sat at the bar, my feet swinging from a stool, Jacksonville, 1972. The adults crowded into a circular booth in the corner. Men pinched women. Women squirmed in squirmy dresses. I smelled the chlorine on my hands as I listened to the cackles of laughter. My father told me I could have as many Shirley Temples as I wanted, but I drank slowly, counting to 50 before taking a single bird-like sip. The cherry bobbed slowly lower in the glass, almost dissolving like candy. I wouldn't eat it until it rested on the bottom. It's good to have rules.
And that is a 100-word story. So let me ask that question. I mean, that does sound poetic to me. I have certainly heard poems that I might confuse with a 100-word story. What is the difference?
Yeah, so there's no scientific definition. You can't put a prose poem or a prose story under a microscope and tell one is a poem and one is a story. It's all about what the author decides it is and what the author decides to call it. And usually when I'm teaching flash fiction, I'll actually ask this trick question where I'll have the students read A Study of the Body by the poet Robert Haas. And it's a beautiful prose poem, as he calls it, but it reads really like a story. And then I'll give them one of my very prose poemy stories and have them, ask them to choose which is the prose poem and which is the story. And they almost always choose the Robert Haas prose poem as the story. And so the lesson being, though, is that the author is in charge of what the criteria or what he or she wants to call it.
So this snapshot that you can give us in flash fiction, in a 100-word story, There are several examples of this in your book, and pretty much every single one left me with so many questions, left me wanting more. Is that the goal?
In part, yeah. I think flash fiction requires more of the reader, in that you're constructing a story not only by the text on the page, but by what you're leaving out. And there's a famous rule of writing that comes from Ernest Hemingway, his iceberg principle, which he says the best stories, like an iceberg, is 90% under the water. Only the top 10% is showing. And so he recommends constructing a story in the same way, just showing the tip of the story, but letting all of that bulk of the story, the iceberg underneath the water, kind of speak up. So omission speaks through the text on the page and the prose. And I think that these flash fiction, even in a greater way, they do that. And a writer, you have to work with the gaps of the story and what's omitted as much as you do the text. And when I was getting my stories down from 150 words to 100 words, that's one of the principles that I learned. You edit these stories as much as you write them.
A 150-word story would definitely qualify as flash fiction. Why do you like the 100-word story so much, that extra parameter?
Yeah, I mean, I write a lot of stories under 1,000 words, so I'm not partial to any one form. And I think the interesting thing about a 1,000-word limit of flash fiction is it's kind of like Russian dolls. You know, there's always like a smaller doll nested within the larger doll until you get all the way down to 6 words, which is generally thought of as the shortest form for a story. But I grew addicted to 100 words just through that initial exercise through my friend Paul's memoir. And so to me, it was an experiment for myself as a writer. And writing short has influenced my longer pieces as well, and my novels. The reason I like it is because it I think constraints bring out a different type of creativity. And this is a very hard constraint of just 100 words. I could define it as 101 or 99, and it would be just as meaningful. But it just happened to be the form that I found and grew an affection for it, and then started the 100-word story journal. So I've just been more deeply involved in it than other flash fiction forms.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Grant Faulkner, author of The Art of Brevity, Crafting the Very Short Story. He's also the executive director of NaNoWriMo and co-founder of the 100-word story. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, I'll talk with two members of the trio BCJ's Peas. They'll be performing at Mission Creek Festival 2023, coming up this weekend in Iowa City. With me now is Grant Faulkner. He is an award-winning writer and the executive director of NaNoWriMo, that's National Novel Writing Month, co-founder of the 100-word story, and he has published several books now on the craft of writing. His most recent is called The Art of Brevity, Crafting the Very Short Story. And so, Grant, we were just talking about crafting that very short 100-word story. Why 100 words is something that means a lot to you, that finish line or that parameter is a little bit arbitrary, but it's something that allows you, I feel, to build your muscles as a writer. Is that, I mean, obviously you're writing the stories because they're good, but also does it help you develop skills that you maybe couldn't develop in another way?
It does. I really do think it is about, you have different writing muscles in your brain or different creative muscles, and some muscles get trained more than others in different forms. And it was interesting to me when we first started the 100-word story journal, we asked a lot of our friends who, you know, were, you know, sometimes acclaimed novelists, and we asked them to write a 100-word story for us. And many times they said they couldn't. you know, it was a very foreign form to them. And I know that they could have if they would have kept practicing it, but it does take practice. And I sometimes think of it as like a track event, you know, like a novel is a marathon and a 100-word story is more like a sprint. And you use different muscles in your body to be a good sprinter versus a good marathoner.
The book is full of exercises for people who are reading the book to try out and try their hand at 100-word stories in different ways. I'm curious. I mean, you have published many 100-word stories. You are the editor of other people's 100-word stories. You published other people's 100-word stories. Is this something where there's enough of a market for flash fiction? Is this something that a writer can specialize in to the exclusion of other kinds of writing?
Yeah, it's been really interesting how flash fiction has emerged and really taken off and become really popular, especially with younger writers. And I don't know if that's because I know that professors and teachers are teaching it more than they used to, and that there are more books and anthologies available. I also think the internet might have something to do with that. You know, like 100-word stories, for instance, you can put 100-word stories in your Facebook update and somebody can read one in its entirety. And so I think there is something about the short form being really conducive to online reading that has helped popularize it a bit.
At the same time, does that kind of communication that we do through social media, does it cheapen it at all? Because people seem to have this feeling that all content should be free and, you know, maybe won't go searching for 100-word stories, but instead will just scroll through a feed. Is that a concern?
No, not at all. I think, one, most stories are free on the internet, even with, you know, revered, established publications. And, you know, I think people have a need for stories and a need for reading. That's the way we connect with ourselves and that's the way we connect with others. So I can only think it's a valuable thing to make stories more free and more available, whether it's on the internet or beyond the internet. And I really think the thing that I would say, though, that I worry about is using the word cheapen to dismiss the form. And so I think 100-word story or other types of flash fiction, they're not meant, because they're short, they're not meant to be read quickly. They're actually more like poems where I think they're meant to be read two or three times. They're actually more demanding in some ways than longer works.
Well, and just from reading this book, I found that some of them, I'm going to say a really good one, just because they were the ones that resonated with me, you find yourself chewing on it for a
exactly.
while later. Your mind drifts back and you think, huh, maybe it was like this.
Yeah. So I think if you encounter stories in your feed or on the internet that are free, I mean, what a fantastic way to enliven your life. And I think we do live our life in these little bits of time confetti, you know, I think we all are very pressed for time. And so I think that that's one reason that flash fiction has become much more popular as well, is that you don't have to sit down for weeks or months to read a whole book. You can read a story at your lunch break. And in fact, you know, just to tell a story about that, smoke long is one of the words for flash fiction. And it comes from China, where flash fiction is very popular. And the way that it became popular in China is that factory workers would have a break in the morning and newspapers would publish a story that was exactly as long as it took to smoke a cigarette. And so that was one definition of flash fiction.
I get the sense from the personal stories that you share in this book that crafting a 100-word story has almost become kind of an addiction or an obsession for you. Would you say that's fair?
Initially, it really was. I don't know if it was a way to avoid my novel, but it just getting a story perfectly within the constraint of 100 words, I became very addicted to it and very passionate about, you know, writing more of them. I'm not as addicted as I used to be because I've written other things since then, but it was a kind of wonderful addiction to start.
Now, you are also the executive director of NaNoWriMo. And for people who aren't familiar, tell us about that organization.
Yeah, big story. It's National Novel Writing Month. And the shorthand for it is that every November, it's a challenge to write 50,000 words of a novel in 30 days. So it's doable. It's one part writing boot camp, and that's the showing up to write about 1,700 words a day in the month. And it's one part big writing party, though, because we have about 300,000 people who participate on our main site, and about 100,000 kids and teens on our Young Writers Program site. And we have 1,000 volunteers around the world, including Central Iowa. Mary Egan from Central Iowa, I'm going to give her a shout out. She organizes in-person writing gatherings so people can come together and they can be galvanized by the motivation and inspiration and support of other people. And that happens online in a variety of forms, too. So it's a really wonderful event because it's the status comes not from publishing your work, but by being creative together. And so the premise is that everyone has a story in them. Everyone has a story that matters, and we help people believe in their stories and encourage them to put their stories into the world.
Let's connect these two passions of yours. So yeah. How can you use the skills that you gain writing flash fiction to implement them in novel writing, using this short form to go long?
Yeah, so I think it's mainly about a sort of aesthetic style, and I see more novels embrace that style. I tend to write more through fragments than I used to do. I write very elliptically. I write with white space, and as I said, omission. So I'm writing with putting in a lot of hints to escalate the narrative rather than explaining things so much. And I would say like Ocean Vuong writes in a very similar way. Rachel Cusk writes in a similar way. Jenny Offal in her Department of Speculation. It's a book that's like the narrative is guided by all of these little snippets. And so I think it's just a different, it allows for a different way of noticing the world. And so the aesthetic is an existential position in that way. By writing through the lens of brevity, you're able to focus on things in a different way and with a different tone and a different mood. So it's just something that I, an aesthetic that I prefer to shape my narrative with.
Do you feel like embracing flash fiction and all of the very short stories you've written, did it change you as a writer?
It did. I think when I mentioned earlier that with Paul's Sport and Jack memoir, how it allowed him to take the small moments in his life and probe them for their significance. That's really what it does for me as a writer as well. I think there are so many moments in our lives to notice, and I think poetry does this too in a very similar way, is it heightens my attention and my attunement to some of the smaller dramas or the smaller moments in my life, and it helps me get them on the page and dramatize them. And that can be whether like from my life or from my imaginary life. But I think that viewing life through that lens allows for different stories to emerge. For instance, like this relates less to me, but for instance, I've heard of people who've experienced a trauma, and when they write about that trauma or tell the story about that trauma, they tend not to shape it into a conventional narrative with a first act, second act, and third act and a rising, you know, trajectory of a narrative arc. It tends to be more fragmentary and more of a collage, where as a reader you're piecing these different things together. It's more fractured. And so that those are things that resonate with me when I write my stories as well.
You have written a lot to guide, encourage, inspire other writers. Of course, NaNoWriMo is all about inspiring other writers. When did you embrace that passion or I guess learn that was something you were skilled at, inspiring other people to get work on the page?
It's a good question. I was a very solitary writer in my 20s and I guess my early 30s as well. And I found a job, my professional home, as I call it, with the National Writing Project, which is an organization focusing on helping teachers teach writing better. And from there, that led to National Novel Writing Month. So I've been involved in organizations that focus on helping people become writers and also discover the meaning of writing in their lives. I've been doing that for over 20 years now, or about 20 years. And so it's been, you know, just a wonderful thing for me as a writer to find this professional home and to be able to work with so many different writers. You know, I work with with very beginning writers, very young writers, beginning writers as adults, and best-selling authors as well, and publishers. So I get to see the whole spectrum of the writing world. And I'm, you know, more and more convinced by how telling our story and writing our stories and being able to read other people's stories naturally as well, that's what connects us as human beings. That's what how we understand ourselves. That's how we understand others. That's how we build empathy and tolerance in the world. It's really how we measure progress as a society, is the stories that we put in the world and recognize.
Writing, of course, is usually a solitary act. You talked about your life as a solitary writer. Do you hear from a lot of people who read your work or connect with your work in another way who are just so grateful to have someone who seems to understand what they need, and, you know, they're writing to connect, and yet they're writing alone? Is that a real hunger from a lot of writers?
It is. I mean, I think every writer shapes themselves differently. Like, I still am a somewhat solitary writer, but my writing community has grown just naturally through my work a lot in the last 20 years. But I'm very interested in, like, with NaNoWriMo, I see younger writers who they love writing with each other. They love being in cafes or libraries and being with each other and, you know, both writing alone, but being together and swapping ideas and collaborating. So I think there are just so many different ways to go about being a writer. So solitary, obviously, is the type of writer that tends to be mythologized. You know, the writer with a great deal of anguish, wadding up pieces of paper and throwing them into the waste can. But I think that there is a lot to be said for a community as well. And I think sometimes writers don't recognize the community around them that supports their creative endeavors. So, I, you know, like anything, though, every artist shapes themselves differently.
You are in the midst of a new project that it's not a done deal yet, but it may be taking the work that you do, encouraging other writers to the masses with a television show, America's Next Great Author. Tell me about this project.
Yeah, I think it's similar to NaNoWriMo in a lot of ways. It's a reality TV show for writers. You know, there have been reality TV shows for everyone, seemingly, including glassblowers. So it's about time writers got their show. And we are going to go to different American cities. You can view it in three acts. Act one is we go to different American cities and we host events called Pitchapaloozas. And basically, you know, 20 people will get up and they'll get 1 minute to pitch their book, and one person will be chosen from each city. And then act two is that those five or six writers will be put in a writer's house, as we're calling it, for a month to write their story. And it's not an elimination show. It's going to be a show about having a supportive community and becoming a creator and believing in yourself and putting your creation into the world. And so the show is going to be really focused on that. It's going to be have a lot of educational components. It's not part of my work at NaNoWriMo, but I really hope the show mirrors that spirit of helping everybody recognize themselves as a creator and be brave enough to put their voice in the world.
I'm still having a hard time imagining what we see people doing. I mean, you mentioned glass blowing. It's a little more visual as a medium than writing.
Well, you know, think about it this way. There is drama anytime you put people together in a house living together. And so there's a rich tradition of reality TV shows that have people living together in a house. And beyond that, though, and they're going to be writing novels together in that house. So we're going to explore their creative journey, but we're going to have a lot of different writing challenges for them, a lot of different writing dares. So it will be very kind of visual. We're not going to just put a camera in front of a writer and watch them type on their laptop. There will be drama.
All right. Well,
there will be people involved.
I'll watch it. I'm completely intrigued. I can't wait to see. Yeah. Hopefully that comes to fruition.
Hey, you know what? If people like watching people bake scones in England, I think they're going to like watching people write novels together in a house.
I hope so. So you do so much to encourage people to write. If there's one piece of wisdom, I'm sure that there are many people listening right now who have tried writing or been frustrated writers or are hopeful writers. If there's one piece of wisdom that you could share with every aspiring writer, what would it be?
You know, I've been asked this so many times, and it's a great question because I've thought about it in so many different ways. And I really recently have just come down to, it sounds like I'm oversimplifying things, but it's actually really hard to carry this out, is to believe in yourself, to believe in your story, to believe that it's good, that it's worthwhile to write. And while you're writing your story, especially if it's a novel or a longer work, you're going to have so many moments where you lose that belief. But it's really about believing in the why you're telling that story, why it matters, and regrouping and regenerating that belief that will really get you to the end. And I think, you know, it doesn't matter if your novel or your memoir is published. What matters is that act of creativity and seeing yourself as a creator and believing yourself as a creator. I think that will enhance your life in so many interesting and unexpected ways that I probably couldn't even anticipate. But I do think it's our stories are the way we make meaning in the world. It's the way we connect with other people. And so I think writing your story just enhances that type of attunement.
Grant Faulkner, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Charity.
Grant Faulkner is a writer. His most recent work is a book called The Art of Brevity, Crafting the Very Short Story. He is also the executive director of NaNoWriMo and co-founder of the lit journal 100 Word Story. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Mission Creek Festival is a three-day celebration of music and literature that happens every spring in Iowa City. This year's festival kicks off on Thursday evening with back-to-back performances at Hancher Auditorium. On Friday and Saturday, the events spread all over downtown with an eclectic mix of speakers and musicians, ranging from the super famous to those on their way to being famous. Mission Creek is an underwriter of IPR, and I'm going to go back to that word eclectic to introduce my next guests. The members of the trio BC Jays Peas met each other in the early 2010s when they were all pursuing graduate degrees in composition at the University of Iowa. They'll be performing their avant-garde soundscape music at 7 p.m. Saturday at the Riverside Theater. And here's a little taste. Brian Penkrott and Justin K. Comer of BC's Jays Peas are with me now. Brian lives in Chicago. Justin lives in Coralville. Brian, hello.
Hi. How are you, Charity?
I'm great. You guys gave me a mouthful to say there, but I'm doing really well. Justin, hello.
Hi. You are doing really well.
Thank you so much. Third member Jason Palomaro lives in Bloomington, Indiana, but he is not with us today. And Justin, I'll let you start. You all met in the 2010s, but this particular trio didn't come together until you'd all gone your separate ways. So back in graduate school, did you guys make music together?
A little bit, yeah. We were in the composition department at the music school, and so we were mostly writing music for other people to play. But as I was finishing my master's, Jason and I started playing a little more together. He worked for the dance department, so we were like accompanying dance improvisation classes. And that's kind of how we got started working together.
All right. And tell me about your musical specialties.
Sure. I'm a saxophonist primarily, but I have continued accompanying dance classes since back then. So I play a little bit of keyboard too. I guess I specialize in improvisation. I work best with as little planning as possible.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. Brian, give me your musical background.
At this point, I play primarily guitar, but I write electronic music. And I grew up playing violin. When I was done with my composition degree and moved back to Chicago, I was in an orchestra for a period of time playing violin. But guitar is really my focus, my love.
So, Justin, you and Jason started playing together in about 2014, doing this work accompanying dancers.
Right.
And that's the point. I guess, Brian, you should tell this story. How did you get involved at that point, and how did the three of you come together?
Well, I'd heard the album that Justin and Jason had released, and I got a chance to see them accompany one of the dance troupes when they all came to Chicago. And really, I love the music, and I thought the process sounded really interesting, and it wasn't something I was really doing in my professional life. And so I sent a message asking if they'd be interested in coming to Chicago, which would be about halfway between each of them, and recording some stuff.
All right. And this was, when did this happen?
That happened in 2019.
Okay, so the three of you came together in 2019, and we'll talk about the music that you recorded together at that point. But Justin, the work that you and Jason were doing together, is it similar to the kinds of sounds that you're creating now?
Yeah, very similar, I think. I think we've gotten better at it, but it is similar. So there's a lot of, we're playing instruments, but it's augmented by a lot of electronic processing and samples and looping and stuff like that. And the process of recording these albums is basically we get in a room together and just improvise for several hours, and then we take those source recordings and sort of craft new pieces of music out of bits and pieces of what we recorded.
So is this similar to what the music that you were creating when you were accompanying, and you continue to accompany dancers, but is it the same kind of thing, or is it this kind of a departure?
There are similarities, although when I am accompanying a dance class, I'm not so much trying to suck up all the attention. It's more of an accompaniment, as
right.
It's called.
So this is more about you.
Yeah. I'm trying to take as much attention away from Brian and Jason as I can. Yeah.
And we you.
It's a battle.
It's everybody's pet project. Yeah.
So, Brian, tell me about recording together. I mean, how do you set this up? How do you prepare for hours of improvisation?
Well, knowing Justin and Jason, I had some confidence that we'd be able to just kind of, you know, pick things up and start making sound and kind of feed off of each other for a while. But, you know, I also wanted to make sure that we didn't get too stuck if there were lulls or if we needed any kind of break from no boundaries. So I came in with a few just kind of loose, maybe like improv games that we could play. And we did. I think we used almost all of them. And at least on my album of our recordings, I think a lot of those games made it in. I thought they were musically kind of interesting and certainly a lot of fun.
Can you give me an example of one of those games?
Sure. One game that we played, I would say we're going to play five notes. You can play any five notes that you want, and then I'd have to count us in at the tempo we would play those five notes. And so what we would get is ideally something that was synchronized and have five notes in a row, but it was unpredictable as far as what that chord would sound like or what that harmony would be. And having a really wide range of fast and slow and high and low, you know, there were moments where it kind of came together. We were all playing in the same low register or we were all playing fast and loud attacks. And all of those, once I took all the silence and the preparation for the game out, is essentially what Zebra was on my album.
Well, and you're referring to your album, so I think I need to explain this. This long recording session that you guys did in 2019 has produced two albums that are now available on Bandcamp. And Brian, the one that you created into its final product is called The Myth Arc. And then Justin, are you responsible for the other album?
Yeah, this is mine. I'm holding it up for you.
All right,
to see.
You are a human being and you deserve this.
Yes.
And so these are created out of the same recording session. Justin, how many hours of recording did you have when you started to pull the pieces to put your album together?
More than six. I remember specifically one 6 hour track, so definitely more than six.
Wow.
And those were just yours. We also shared our own. We all recorded individually, and so we all shared these individual recordings with each other. So we had three times the amount of recording to split up and choose from.
All right. Well, why don't you describe the myth arc for me, Brian, so we get an idea of what you created out of these sessions?
In putting together these tunes, I'll call them, I didn't have a plan necessarily. Once they all started taking shape and I started listening through them and kind of finding out what the pace was going to be, I was able to start to imagine at least some sort of arc, right? Starting kind of slow and getting faster and then getting quieter and then kind of finishing with a great big fade out. And that is just kind of a satisfying line of story that I can follow. And I've worked with this poet named Thea Brown, another Iowa alum, and I had a collection of her poems that she had sent me for a project. And one of the poems that didn't make it into another project was one that I'd actually always wanted to work with. There were so many good lines in it. And one of the lines in that poem was everybody is looking for the myth arc, which is, to my mind, you know, trying to see things that justify things, whether or not they're there, which always reminds me of concept albums from the 70s, right? They all had concepts, whether or not they worked. And so that was, from that point, that is how I would describe myth arc.
With bringing the spoken word element into it, is that something that became a part of it after the fact, or did you incorporate that during that recording session?
It came after the fact. The spoken word was not something I had necessarily intended to do. It was once the recordings were being parsed and cobbled together. Yeah, you know, I'm constantly trying to assess what is this need, what would make this move quicker or better or slower, just more effectively. And so the incorporation of the spoken word became something that I ended up relying on after the fact.
And I've listened to both of these albums, and you can tell that they're related, you know, they're siblings perhaps, but they do sound really different. So to give us an idea, a contrast, Justin, your version of this, you are a human being and you deserve this, which sounds both menacing and maybe nice.
Oh yes, I'm right? So glad that you got that out of it.
Definitely on edge here. I'm either gonna get a slap or a hug, I'm not sure. So how does it differ?
Mine is very much about me, I think. It pulls a lot of voicemails that I received in the final months of 2019 and the early months of 2020. And my life was very busy in the months leading up to the pandemic. And I think that that's reflected in these six tracks here. The opening and closing tracks are sort of set in like a noisy bar. There's crowd noise underneath me addressing the crowd. And it sort of sounds like there's a house band, like playing lounge music or whatever. It's not lounge music, but and then the intention is that the house band is then taking the listener on a journey of some sort of emotional transformation, and whatever happens, this can be taken positively or negatively. You deserve this.
We in listening to your tracks with the voicemails, You have taken those recordings and then you've dubbed in your name for every other person's name. So your name just keeps coming up again and again and again. So when you say it's about you, I mean, it really does. It feels that way.
Yeah. I think that I don't see myself as being very good at self-expression. But then this album, I think I do it very bluntly.
It's very expressive.
Yeah.
Justin from the Bernie campaign. I'm just checking in. We'd like to invite you to the debate watch party on Wednesday at the office. We're hoping for like an early Thanksgiving if you want to bring a dish.
And I love the covers of these albums, too, because Justin, the cover of your album is kind of a whole collection of obscured faces. But then, Brian, you have different budgies and then a few famous cartoon birds.
Correct. Yeah.
what does that say to you?
The relation between the two? Or
No, those budgies. I just want to talk about them.
Oh, okay. I love the layout of Justin's cover, and I wanted to have something that related. And one of the lines in Thea's poem, actually the second to last line, is speak your nothing into a well of clambering budgies, all pecking at the cereal box in the corner. So I got together as many clambering budgies as I could, and then in the corners I put famous cereal birds.
Nice. You're going to be performing live at Mission Creek. Justin, have you guys performed live in front of an audience with this music before?
No, not with this music and not with this group of people. Jason and I performed live many times as JCJP, the precursor to BCJSPs. But this will be the first time presenting any of this work in a live setting.
And will it be this work or will it be something entirely different?
So I mentioned that I improvise a lot, and so does Brian. And, you know, that was the impetus of all of this. But what we will be performing on Saturday is very practiced, and like we've timed it. We've rehearsed many times. It is a set that we have prepared.
Was that challenging for you to tie yourself down in that way?
Kind of. I mean, it's not like I've never practiced before, but I don't
You have a composition degree. I think you've probably done a few things, right?
Yeah. And there are still spaces in the set that we can kind of test out different directions. But certainly, I think rehearsing things that took rehearsal that felt maybe a little more daunting at the beginning than we realized or you thought they would.
Yeah.
The music that you make, Brian, is so different from the kind of thing that gets radio play or that makes it on playlists that people listen to most of the time. What do you want people in your audience to experience with you with this music?
Oh, well, I want fellow travelers, right? That idea of a journey where you start somewhere and end somewhere else. I want people to feel things and, you know, kind of question everything that's happening around them all the time, whether they're listening to my music or walking down the street or whatever. I think asking questions is great. So if I can craft something that takes them on a journey and, you know, gets them excited or happy or makes them feel calm or there's some sort of catharsis, that'd be a real victory, I'd say.
Do you have anything you want to add, Justin?
Yeah, I pretty much every time I get in front of a crowd of people, my goal is for them to hear something they've never heard before and to say like, oh, I didn't know a saxophone could do that, or I didn't know music could be formed this way. I didn't know that the sound I'm hearing now could be considered music.
Right.
Oh, Justin, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Charity.
And Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Penkrot and Justin K. Comer of BCJSPs. They'll be performing their avant-garde soundscape music at 7 p.m. Saturday at the Riverside Theater as part of Mission Creek Festival. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News. Our producers are Samantha McIntosh, Caitlin Troutman, and Danny Gear. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.